This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, after gaining an historic murder conviction of a killer cop, anti-police repression forces in Chicago are gearing up for a massive campaign to change the makeup of the entire city government. And supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal are preparing for another court hearing in their 37-year-long struggle to throw out his conviction in the death of a Philadelphia policeman. But first, Senator Bernie Sanders, who's presumed to be getting ready for another run at the Democratic presidential nomination, last month unveiled a 10-point domestic program full of multi-trillion-dollar initiatives for Medicare for All health care, a massive remake of U.S. national infrastructure, free college tuition, and a dismantling of the mass incarceration regime. But Sanders has little to say on foreign policy or about reducing the military budget that eats up most of federal tax monies. Frustrated with Sanders, over 100 noted intellectuals and activists sent a letter calling on the senator to come out against U.S. militarism. David Swanson is a veteran anti-war activist and publisher of the influential website War is a Crime. He was one of the framers of that letter.
Senator Sanders gives the same speech multiple times a day, doesn't seem to be influenced by anyone, doesn't seem to alter it for anything. Groups that have temporarily persuaded of him of something through intervening in his events, such as Black Lives Matter, have to be disappointed because their talking points have long since vanished from Bernie Sanders' speech. And he is in the right place on ending a U.S. war in Yemen. And it's a bill with a giant loophole. There are numerous procedural steps and then a veto and then noncompliance. But it's a wonderful, wonderful precedent for Congress to step up after a couple of centuries and do its job and possibly end a war, which is why the veto threat, which is why they sent Mattis and Pompeo scurrying over to the Senate on Wednesday to try to stop the thing. But when you talk about ending particular wars because your partners are violating human rights, as if you could have wars that don't violate human rights, when you talk about the thing in isolation and then every other word that comes out of your mouth is about domestic policy and economy and budgets as if the military doesn't exist, and you never indicate what you'd like the military to be, what its budget should be reduced to or increased to. And this goes to a critique of Elizabeth Warren's speech on Thursday as well. If you're going to talk about ending wars to be better prepared for other wars and ending weapons that don't kill enough people fast enough, and talking about the deaths in Iraq as 6,000 rather than over a million, it's not just a shortcoming, it's incoherent to have a public policy that ignores over 60% of federal discretionary spending that goes into militarism. How do you do that?
Yes, the real third rail in terms of both corporate policies is defense spending. But you point out in your letter that majorities of the American people want cuts in the war budget.
They absolutely do, even though they don't have the slightest clue what it is. They want it cut. And when pollsters have sat them down and showed them what the budget is, they want it cut severely. They want money moved to education, to environment. So if we just had democracy rather than bombing people in its name, we would be on the right course toward progress and peace. But we don't. Instead, we have a system of politics that talks about the other 39% of federal discretionary spending as if it were everything, and whether it should be bigger and whether it should be smaller and what should be done with it. And you can't do much with it. And you can't talk about environmentalism and addressing climate change while ignoring both the place where all the money is and the top destroyer of the environment, which is the military. You can't talk about xenophobia and bigotry and racism and fascism without looking at what academic studies have just recently been reconfirming is the big driver of these sorts of hatred and hateful violence. And that is militarism and bombing people and training people to shoot and bomb people and having them come back home. You can't talk about civil liberties without addressing the top cause of the erosion of civil liberties, the reason for the violations of our rights, for the secrecy in our government. And you can't talk about a future at all with the threat of nuclear apocalypse higher than it's ever been and almost not a word said about it. It's terrific to be doing something on Yemen. And if it happens, it will set a standard. If you can pick a war and end it, why can't you pick a second one and a third one and a fourth one and not start any new ones? But there's no way to have a progressive platform and an international progressive front without admitting that militarism exists and addressing it.
Stopping a war doesn't cost money. It saves money as well as lives. But how does Bernie Sanders think he's going to succeed with his 10 points, which in addition to the costs of Medicare for all, we're talking about trillions of dollars in spending in terms of paying for tuition-free colleges, a revamp of the nation's infrastructure, doing away with mass incarceration, if that means providing jobs and education for those targeted communities. That's big money. But Nancy Pelosi, Senator Sanders' leader, has a pay-as-you-go policy.
She also has an immunity from impeachment policy, which is why if they end a war, the president will decide whether or not he feels like ending that war. It's an excellent question because candidate for president Bernie Sanders was asked over and over again this question, how will you pay for everything? And his answer was typically quite complicated and almost always involved raising taxes. And he would explain in the fine print who he was raising taxes on and so forth. A far, far superior answer, really, practically, morally, and politically, would have been, I'll cut a little fraction of the never audited Pentagon budget. This is an answer I did hear Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez give once, but I've heard her give a more Bernie Sanders-ish answer more often. And I see the draft of this Green New Deal, meaning the Democrats' Green New Deal, and it pretends that foreign policy doesn't exist, that militarism doesn't exist, that 96% of humanity isn't out there. What we need from these people are concrete plans and commitments to do things like ending the war on Yemen. But beyond that, in every other policy area, you get actual proposals like Medicare for all, like free college. You don't have a way to pay for them without ending the military or creating the sort of taxes on billionaires and millionaires and corporations that have never been seen before. But you have these policies. When it comes to foreign policy, the best Elizabeth Warren came up with on Thursday was bring our troops home from Afghanistan starting now. You know, it's a lovely phrase, starting now, because it sounds like it makes stronger what you've just said, whereas, of course, it actually weakens it. It's not the same as finishing now. They've been starting now to bring U.S. troops home from Afghanistan for years and years, and this is the same position that Senator Sanders takes.
Well, I want you to speculate. Why do Bernie Sanders and the others who call themselves progressives and have these very expensive programs that they offer to the people, why do they so studiously avoid saying that they've got to be paid for by reductions in the war budget?
I think a big chunk of it, other than just habit and inertia, has to be deference to the corporate media, which also raises concerns about the system of relatively independent media that Bernie Sanders has got working for him. Why isn't it allowing him the sense of freedom to speak that way? Why isn't it encouraging him to speak that way? You know, Bernie Sanders gave a big speech at George Washington University, and it was aired on C-SPAN, and he talked for over an hour, the whole progressive platform, as if 96% of humanity doesn't exist, no foreign policy. And then someone asked him a question. They said, what's a progressive foreign policy? And he spoke for a couple of minutes purely about Yemen, which was great as far as it went, and got, I think, the loudest applause of the night. So it's not because it isn't popular. It's not because if you said, I'll pay for all of these things by cutting 8% of military spending, people wouldn't yell and scream and vote for you. It's not because people don't care. It's not because the top answer on all the exit polls last time the public gave the Democrats the majority back in 2006 wasn't, it's because we want out of Iraq. You know, it's not because foreign policy can't be a winner in U.S. politics. Because the corporate media hates peace. The corporate media loves war. The corporate media says it's presidential to bomb people. I think that has to be a major part of it. Bernie Sanders has, you know, compromised himself, has treated major weapons programs as job programs, which is false as well as immoral. He's got the F-35 there in Burlington. But I don't think it's really driven by financial corruption so much as deference to what's acceptable in the major corporate media outlets, which he's willing to criticize them explicitly, but he doesn't seem willing to say the things they don't want said.
Your letter points out that many of the signers campaigned for Bernie Sanders and are willing to campaign for him again. But I guess he's not going to change his tune and include foreign policy and peace and cutting the war budget in his campaign unless those supporters dog him and dog him and dog him.
I think you're right. My original draft said, we would have worked for you if you had been a candidate for peace. And I edited it to say some of us did work for you anyway, because it made a much longer list of prominent people signing the letter. But I think it is important for people to disrupt his events, to hand out information at his events, as people are doing as we speak in Burlington, and to challenge him and say, we will not support you. We will not work for you. We will work for somebody else if you don't make a commitment for peace and create a coherent platform that includes peace, and begin by answering the first question in U.S. politics: is 60% of the federal discretionary budget for militarism the right amount? And if not, what amount should it be?
And we must point out that the Green Party, which will be running its candidates again, does have a position on reduction of the war budget.
Well, of course it does, and it's far superior and always has been, and it's up against the corporate media and the ballot access and the debate access and the financial corruption and all the other forces, which of course will lead people to make the decision either to vote for them despite their very, very slim chances of getting anywhere, or to do lesser evil voting. And I don't think we should spend a whole heck of a lot of time losing our voices on that argument. My problem is with lesser evil thinking and lesser evil activism. And so when it comes to election day, if you want to do your lesser evil vote, fine. But the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day, if you treat the evil you voted for as if it's something other than evil, and put yourself on its team and ask it what you should work for and lobby for and pressure for, you're part of the problem. I mean, I just watched a video this week of former President Barack Obama in Texas bragging to a crowd of people about how he did more to expand oil drilling and oil production and fossil fuel creation in the United States than anybody else, bragging about his role in advancing the destruction of this planet as a habitable place for humanity. The fact that you can find somebody even worse does not excuse that in any way. So, you know, vote for it if you have to, but don't work for it and don't cheer for it and don't restrict your efforts at nonviolently acting to halt it and reverse it, which is, you know, far, far more important than voting, no matter who you vote for.
Have the letter signers and senders been in touch with Bernie Sanders' immediate staff?
At least to some extent, in that one of the signers of the letter, John Rohr, who happens to live in Burlington, Vermont, has taken many copies of it to a big meeting that Senator Sanders is having with lots of friends and allies there in Burlington just these couple of days, and has given it to and spoken with people close to Bernie Sanders there and involved in his campaign. And so there are reasons to believe it has reached Bernie Sanders, both through the media and directly in hard copy. There is yet to emerge any evidence of any change in Senator Sanders' rhetoric or policy platform, but there is reason to press him and everybody else in U.S. politics in this direction and see how far we can get any of them to go.
And the letter's not closed. Folks who agree with it can still sign on, right?
Exactly. The more people that sign, the more likely that Senator Sanders and others are to listen. And you can sign it at worldbeyondwar.org/Bernie.
That was anti-war activist David Swanson speaking from Washington. Black activists in Chicago plan to build on their recent victory with the historic murder conviction of the cop that killed Laquan McDonald by changing the balance of power of the city's board of aldermen. Aislinn Pulley is with Black Lives Matter Chicago. She says the momentum is on the movement side.
This is the first time in the history of Chicago that a white police officer has been convicted of murdering a Black person. So this has never happened in the city. And this is the first time in 50 years that an on-duty cop has been convicted. We're still researching the historical significance of this as nationally, but there's only been 13 police officers nationally within the history of this country with the modern police force post-slavery who have been convicted of murder. The majority of the time, murder charges are demoted down to manslaughter. So we're really still analyzing the full scope of what this means. Right now, we're still in the sentencing period, and that will take a while. We're expected to come back to court in January to figure out, you know, what the appeals process is, because of course they're gonna appeal and do all of that. Sentencing has not happened yet. We are also in the fourth day of the CPD conspiracy trial, which again is the very first time that has ever happened in the city of Chicago, where three officers are being charged with conspiring to cover up the Laquan McDonald murder by copying and forging signatures on police reports. We've heard very damning testimony this week from an officer who testified that the first time she found out her signature had been forged was in a news report. A witness testified yesterday saying that the cops absolutely lied. And so what we're still seeing is that this is absolutely not done. And in terms of political accountability, there are 34 alder people who are still in city council who were all a part of the conspiracy to hide the video. And so we want full accountability for every single person who covered this up, as well as all of the other murders that have happened in Chicago.
Well, basically, you seem to be treating this whole thing as a criminal enterprise, not just the crimes of one cop.
Yes, that is absolutely accurate. It's a criminal enterprise that conspires to cover up the murder and brutality, violence, terrorism, and torture of our people, which has been the normal functioning of the police since its inception. And we are slowly beginning to open up political space to expose the true horrific reality of this. You know, it took decades for John Burge to finally be convicted, not of torture, but of lying under oath for the torture. We still have people who are incarcerated as a result of his torturing. John Burge, for people who don't know, was a former Chicago police commander who led a torture ring from the 70s through the 90s and tortured over 120 primarily Black men in the city. And because of the persistent fight of survivors and their family members, we were able to win a reparations ordinance, the first time in this country that any reparations ordinance for survivors of police terrorism has ever been accomplished. But we still have survivors who are incarcerated due to the tortured confessions that were elicited. We still have cops that are torturing. We have Holman Square, which is the Black site that exists on the west side of Chicago that was exposed by The Guardian and the Independent newspaper in Britain. So it absolutely is a conspiracy. It's a government conspiracy, systemic conspiracy that has been part of the status quo since day one.
So this whole torture and brutality and mass incarceration machine is backed up by most of the majority Black and Hispanic Board of Aldermen in Chicago.
Yes, absolutely. We have one alderman, Alderman Carlos Rosa, who has stood by our side, who is a former organizer and marched with us in the streets, and who has stood for the call for community control of the police. We only have one alder person out of the entire city council, and we used to have none. So yes, they are all complicit.
So what do we do about that board of aldermen?
Well, because Chicago is such a city that every day something crazy happens, we actually have Alderman Burke, whose offices were raided yesterday by the FBI. So hopefully he is on his way out. Alderman Cochran from Woodlawn has just been indicted as well on corruption charges. And he was also complicit in the cover-up of Laquan McDonald. But the other remaining 32 are up for re-election in February, and all of them need to be voted out and held accountable.
And explain to us the dimensions of community control of the police, what you're pushing, and which is the centerpiece of changing the nature of the Board of Aldermen.
Yeah, so what we are proposing is called CPAC for short, and it stands for Civilian Police Accountability Council. It's something that does not exist anywhere in this country. It's not a police board or a community police board, and people kind of get that conflated. What we are calling for is democratic control of the police by the people. And that means that the people would be able to hire and fire, the superintendent would be able to hold accountable police officers who commit crimes against the people. We would have control of the budget. We would have control of the rules and regulations that govern policing. So this means we would be disempowering the current structure by taking power away from the mayor. The mayor is the one right now who appoints the superintendent. It's not a democratic process. He appoints the police board. It's unelected. And the FOP is the one who essentially dictates all of the rules and operating of CPD. And FOP is basically a legalized equivalent of the KKK when it comes to our people. We are disempowering all of those entities and putting it into the power of the community, of the people. We would have every neighborhood, all 77 neighborhoods in the city, would be able to vote and vote in elected representatives. And no police law enforcement officers would be able to serve on this council. We have 55,000 people who have signed cards to support this, and support is growing massively. So this is what we want, and this is what we are demanding.
And you've got the support of the teachers' union in this.
Absolutely. The teachers' union has come out strong. After the release of the Laquan McDonald video, you know, they came out and were very public in their support. We have support of many unions. many organizations, many churches. So this is really a representative body of the community, of the actual people who live here for the first time. It's not law enforcement agents. It's not former prosecutors, which is basically what the police board is made up of. It's the community.
And in Chicago, which has the highest proportion of police to citizens, the police budget is in fact an all-devouring mechanism that prevents community programs from being funded, in fact.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the example of Chicago and exposing the horrors of neoliberalism is really, really important to illustrate. Chicago's budget largest line item is policing. Over 40% of our city budget goes toward policing. That results in over $4 million a day. Contrast that with the fact that in 2013, Rahm Emanuel conducted the largest public school closing in the history of this country by closing over 50 schools. The year before that, he closed half of our public mental health centers. And so all of the arguments that were waged was to save money, that there wasn't enough funding, there wasn't enough money for healthcare, there wasn't enough money for education. It took us 4 years, led by the youth of STOP, which is an organization on the South Side, to win us a trauma center on the South Side. And people were dying because it took too long to get them to the North Side or to downtown where there was a Area 1 trauma center. This extreme neglect and extreme divestment has crippled and is killing and harming our community. And instead of providing what we actually need to survive, they are putting more and more funding into policing. And it's the perfect example of the neoliberal political project of divestment from the people and putting it into the hands of the police in order to protect the immense wealth of the elite.
And is there not a connection between gentrification and adversarial policing that is creating a hostile environment to live for those communities that are targeted for gentrification?
Yeah, absolutely. And that links into so many other components of the tensions that exist within this city. Chicago has been named the most segregated city in this country, and that is for a reason. And the violence that exists and that is constantly referenced by the media and exploited is a representation of the fact that we live in such horrible conditions. And the gap between Black people and white people in the city is enormous. Since 2013, the average household income of white people has increased by 20% to over $100,000 a year. For Black households, it has decreased by 4% to $35,000 for a household. I mean, that's a huge gap in wealth. So the reality is that there's a small minority of people who are living quite fine, but there's a huge majority of us that are struggling. And when people struggle, they have the same biological and physical needs as a rich person. They need to eat, and they are going to eat by any means necessary. And that means that creates survival economies. So this violence that the media, you know, tends to point to and that Trump loves to highlight has to be understood within the context of divestment and neoliberalism.
And in terms of community control of police and defunding the police, which Black Lives Matter also supports, how much support have you gotten from the preaching classes?
You know, it's split. There definitely are some radical members of the faith community who come out and who have been a tremendous comrade in struggle. But there are also examples of members of faith community who side with, you know, some of the most conservative and backward and right-wing political arguments and have betrayed our people and have consequently received a lot of money from Rahm Emanuel and from Governor Rauner.
So as you gear up for the community control of police campaign and the very much related campaign to change the way the city council, the aldermen, look, do you think you've got those elements scared? Are they taking you serious after this verdict?
Oh, yeah. They're all scared. They're scared so much so that a number of the candidates, including the former head of COPA, which is basically, it's the appointed oversight board of the police that Rahm Emanuel runs, Lori Lightfoot, has come out in support of our No Cop Academy campaign. And what we are doing with that campaign, and it's a coalitional campaign of over 100 organizations, is we are saying Rahm Emanuel is trying to build a new police academy in the city on the west side where Laquan McDonald was killed, and is proposing that it's going to cost $95 million. And what we are saying is no, we absolutely do not need another. This would be a second police academy in this city. And after he conducted the largest public school closing in U.S. history and closed half of our mental health centers and have driven Black people out of the city, shut down our jobs, shut down our housing, hell no, he is not going to build a police academy where we need schools, where we need housing, where we need healthcare centers. And so that campaign has been so successful that a lot of the mayoral candidates have now given lip service to say that no, Rahm Emanuel is wrong and they support the community's demand. And so, yeah, this is a reflection of the fight of the people, and they are scared. They should be scared, because just like we got Rahm Emanuel out, just like we got Anita Alvarez out, we will get the rest of them out.
And what about President Obama's presidential center? How does it fit into this entire scheme of things, if at all?
It fits in. It's a perfect example of gentrification. So where they want to place the Obama Center is in Woodlawn. And Woodlawn is on the south side that has about 20,000 abandoned buildings and is a neighborhood that was extremely divested in, who had schools closed. And what they're trying to do is put in this center that's going to effectively displace the residents of that area. There was a property owner there who was a well-known slumlord who rose the rent in his building up by 200% and gave the tenants a 7-day notice because of the expected increase in real estate that the Obama Center is supposed to bring. We were able to support the organizing of this organization called STOP, which I mentioned before, who organized and protested with the tenants of that building and were able to fight that. And so he was forced to then reverse his decision. But we're fighting that. We're demanding a community benefits agreement that mandates that there will be no push out of the people, because of course that's what will happen with anything like this. And he has not come out in support. He's actually come out against it. And this has been his tradition. This should not be seen as an anomaly, has supported the corporate powers and not supported the people. So we are in a fight trying to save this neighborhood and resist the seduction of gentrification that's going to end up displacing even more Black people from the city. This moment that we're in Chicago has been a result of decades and decades of the people rising up, of torture survivors rising up and demanding that their story be heard and that there be accountability, of families rising up. And that is not going to stop. The Democratic Party has a stronghold in this city. And in order to really get to the crux of why we live in such violence, why the police operate so violently and murderously, we have to get deeper and look at this system. And that means that the whole bi-party narrative of legitimacy needs to be challenged. The Democrats offer us nothing. Mayor Rahm Emanuel was a Democrat. The Democrats who conspired to murder Chairman Fred Hampton were in power. We need to look beyond that. This is the time when we can push further and really get at the root of why we live in this system and why policing, which came out of slavery, is still enacting the essential same role today, which is protecting the wealth of the ruling class.
Aislinn Pulley of Black Lives Matter Chicago. Supporters of the nation's best-known political prisoner scrambled to bring as many activists to Philadelphia as possible for another court hearing in Mumia Abu-Jamal's challenge to his life prison sentence in the 1981 death of a police officer. Johanna Fernandez is with the campaign to bring Mumia home. She was interviewed by Black Agenda radio producer Kyle Frazier.
This will mark the ninth time that we've convened before Judge Tucker to discuss whether or not Judge Castile should have recused himself from hearing appeals in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal on the basis of conflict of interest. The reason why Judge Castile should have recused himself is because he prosecuted Mumia when he served as DA in Philadelphia. So he was involved in Mumia's prosecution as DA and later reviewed his case when Mumia presented a whole host of issues during his appeals hearing to one of the higher courts in Pennsylvania. So what is the latest? Essentially, the judge heard more arguments from both of the attorneys, and one of the things that surfaced, which was different this time around, was that the judge asked questions on this issue of adverse inference. And the law essentially states that if there are any documents missing or documents that one side or the other fails to produce, the defendant should not be held accountable. And essentially, it should be assumed that if that document is to surface, it would enhance the case of the defendant, in this case, Mumia Abu-Jamal. And what was interesting about this issue as it was being addressed in court is that the judge, Judge Tucker, cross-examined, if you will, the prosecutor, and ended up by asking the prosecutor, well, quote, so what you mean to say is that perhaps the defendant has a case of adverse inference, unquote. And the prosecutor said yes, and then attempted to reel herself back. So this is a really wonderful moment in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, given that the DA of Philadelphia has failed over and over again to deliver on these missing documents, these files that should be kept by the DA's office but somehow have been missing. And what do these files say? Essentially, these documents are the responding part of memos that were written by Castile or his assistants, in which he has pretty much shown himself, or these documents suggest, that he was tracking death penalty cases and asking politicians essentially to sign execution warrants. And in each of these memos or letters, Mumia's name has clearly appeared as one of the defendants and one of the death row inmates that Castile's office, when he was DA of Philadelphia, was tracking and, you know, discussing with politicians and asking folks like former Governor Bob Casey to pursue and sign an execution warrant. So in one of these cases, in one of these memos, in a letter, Castile is urging Bob Casey send a clear and dramatic message, unquote, to police killers. So we have the letter that Castile wrote to Bob Casey, but we don't have the response on the part of Bob Casey. And part of what our lawyers are saying is that this is clear evidence that DA Ronald Castile was clearly and personally involved in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, which is the standard necessary to prove conflict of interest or a violation of due process and a violation of Mumia's constitutional rights to a fair trial.
And given the nature of this case since 81 and all of the irregularities with respect to evidence and documents, to what degree does this particular issue reflect the larger history as regards the courts in Pennsylvania? And how does that align with this vision of Philadelphia turning a corner as regards law enforcement and the legal system, particularly under new District Attorney Larry Krasner?
Well, the new District Attorney Larry Krasner promised that he was going to right by the Constitution and that he was going to bring justice to a whole series of cases in Philadelphia in which there has been police corruption or tampering with evidence. He, in fact, campaigned on this issue and won. And he has, in fact, attempted to reform the criminal justice system and his office, except in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. He's been unwilling to grant relief. And in fact, his prosecutors, who have showed up to court in the last year, have put on this charade that Ronald Castile, as prosecutor and DA of Philadelphia, was not directly involved in the city's most famous case involving the killing of a white police officer by a former Black Panther, Mumia Abu-Jamal. So the DA gets a failing grade on this issue of bringing justice to his office in Philadelphia, because he is failing to bring justice to one of the most important cases in that city's history. Now, to your question of how does this failure on the part of the DA's office to produce the files we need in order to, without a doubt, prove what we already know, that Ronald Castile was involved in prosecuting Mumia's case, in part because Mumia's enemies have historically been the Fraternal Order of Police. And in fact, Judge Ron Castile was elected to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court because he was financed by the Fraternal Order of Police, and the Fraternal Order of Police named him Man of the Year. He was quoted in the press saying that his office had to make an example out of cop killers, quote unquote, and there were only two cop killers at the time that he was referring to, Mumia and some unknown other defendant. So of course, when he said that to Bob Casey and made reference to that in the press, he must have been referring to the most famous quote unquote cop killer in the history of Philadelphia, Mumia Abu-Jamal, which then suggests that he was personally and directly involved in pursuing the death sentence in Mumia's case. So the question of whether the actions of the Philly prosecutor's office is in line with the history of this case, it's in line with the history of this case. What have we seen in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal? We've seen that whenever Mumia makes a claim, all of a sudden the courts in the country, not just in Pennsylvania or in Philadelphia, but the federal courts, change precedent. So the perfect example of that came about 15 years ago when Mumia presented the Batson issue before the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the federal court immediately before the Supreme Court. The Batson issue is a very important issue that most defendants who present good evidence get relief on. And this is the issue of discrimination in jury selection. So Mumia presented clear evidence, or his attorneys did, before the Third Circuit Court, a violation of Batson. And the courts came back and said that there was no violation of Batson, that there was no discrimination in jury selection, when we have clear, uncontrovertible proof that there was. And even though the majority of the judges in that issue opposed granting Mumia relief. One of the judges, in fact, wrote an opinion, the sole dissenting judge, Judge Thomas, I think his name was, and he said, quote, in his opinion, "I see no reason why this court should deny Abu Jamal the courtesy of our precedent," unquote. I will repeat. That judge, the sole dissenting judge in the Third Circuit Court on the issue of Batson, said, quote, "I see no reason why this court should not afford Abu Jamal the courtesy of our precedents," unquote. Meaning that we've granted relief to defendants who presented the same evidence that Abu Jamal has presented. So why aren't we affording Mumia the same rights? So what we see in each of these instances is in which Mumia has presented a grievance and asked for relief on a particular constitutional issue is that the Pennsylvania courts and the federal courts have applied what is known today as the Mumia exception. The Mumia exception, which is that laws and precedents will be rewritten in Mumia's case. And once his case is out of the limelight, the court goes back to granting defendants relief on the same issue that Mumia has presented. And essentially, Mumia's case, as you know, is a very political case, one in which the entire establishment in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania has lobbied on and rallied around to ensure that he stays in prison. Mumia's case has been used in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania to ascend political office. Politicians have been elected when they have manipulated fears of white people across the state around Mumia's case as the cop killer that needs to be kept in prison or executed. So in many ways, Mumia's case has, over the last 30-some-odd years, fattened and strengthened the criminal justice system and the apparatus of repression in Pennsylvania, and they want to keep it that way. But we are fighting, and we're not going to stop fighting until we see Mumia walk out of those prison walls.
Johanna Fernandez of the Campaign to Bring Mumia Home. PAM Africa is part of International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and she's Minister of Information for the MOVE organization. MOVE has supported Mumia ever since his arrest in 1981, just as Mumia, as a young radio reporter, was one of the few that provided coverage to the MOVE 9, who were imprisoned in the death of a Philadelphia cop in 1978. PAM Africa explained why they had to scramble to get to court for the latest hearing.
It's best to describe what went on in the courtroom and in the hallways last week to let you know how strong this movement is and how this government is so used to breaking things down in time and that people would get, you know, frustrated and walk away, because we had people when Mumia was on the obvious death row, and because when you're in prison, you're still on death row, but the obvious death row. And our people kept telling us, you know, you'll never get him off of death row. And some people thought he was guilty, and other people just could not believe that we would be able to get him off of death row. But they didn't understand the commitment of MOVE and John Africa to keep Mumia out there and to continue to get the information that brings people in. And with that understanding, throughout the years, we've done millions for Mumia and all, you know, and a lot of great things, you know, for Mumia. And some things were small and some things was big, but never, ever did we come upon a time that we didn't do something for Mumia. And in between that time, I want to explain what keeps this movement going is that we continue to do the work, put the information out no matter what. And people come and they go for whatever various reasons that they have. economic reasons and or family reasons, people getting, you know, sick or, you know, just taking on another livelihood. But when they come back and when they go out into wherever they're going to, they be able to carry the word of what's happening with Mumia. Right now, every time Mumia has gone to court, we were able to fill that courtroom and able to fill the streets up for Mumia, no matter what kind of little devious tricks that this government would have to try to break this movement. The last time we were in court, the FOP was there because they tried other kind of tactics before. But this last time we was in court, they had every kind of cop agency that there was upstairs in the hallway. They had their guns on. In fact, they were the guys who, when you got ready to go into the courtroom, they were the ones who were standing at the door, and they brought top sheriffs in. And that was all designed to intimidate people. When we got into the courtroom, the Faulkner family was already in there. So we wasn't able to put as many people in the courtroom as we desired. But in the courtroom, Maureen Faulkner, you know, started making an outburst because the judge had granted a 30-day extension so that our side could be able to check out some other information and submit that information that's detrimental to Mumia's life. She was objecting, and the judge had to put her out. And when she came out, now, mind you, they have cameras up there. And, you know, we're going to be having, you know, we're getting that information as well, too. The camera showed, and our people in the hallway, no disruption, anything, because we warned them. We felt that something was going to happen that day, right? So we warned them to don't fall into any tricks that the police do, because we're upstairs on that floor. We don't have cell phones. We don't have no kind of weapons. We're dealing with people who have cell phones and every kind of police person that there is be there for the Faulkner side. They were in the courtroom. So when Mrs. Pukovic, because that's her name, it is not Faulkner. She was Maureen Faulkner, but she's Maureen Faulkner Pukovic. And when she came out, when Miss Pukovic came out, and that's the widow of Daniel Faulkner, when she came out, she looked and what she realized that in all these 30-something, I believe we're up to 37, you know, years coming in, that whenever she looked out there, there I was, and I was there with Mumia, and she'd just been thrown out the courtroom. So she comes out and she's angrily looking at me, and all like she can just tear me apart, right? So as she come by, she's looking me right in the face. So I said, well, what's wrong, Mrs. Pukovic? You know, so she walked, took a few steps, and it must hit her, and she spun around, and she said, you bitch. Now, when the guards heard that, they immediately went to descend on our supporters. But people was howling out that we didn't say bitch. It was Maureen who said bitch, and it was to me who she had called. The thing with this is, because I'm filing charges against her, and it's more so because I'm telling you, we were up in that hallway. There were men, women, and children up there with cops with guns and all who's known for shooting, maiming, killing. And she comes out surrounded by police. And had we not warned people that there was something going to happen, it could have been a situation when she called me a bitch that I might have responded in a way that will cause a situation or some of the other people in the hallway. But it didn't get into anything. I say this to say that our movement is a very respectable movement. Oh, yes, we will demonstrate about what's going on, about the injustice, and we have taken over the streets. We have shut them down and everything, but we have never caused a problem where people can be arrested. She put us in a dangerous situation, and that's what I'm filing charges about. And you know how, you know, when there is no riot and police charge you with inciting a riot. That's what she did on that floor. That's what I'm charging her with. And the reason why I'm speaking out about, because we have to go back to that courtroom, and we will be in number as many as possible. And we're just finding out, so we're fastly acting to get people there. At the same time, we want to point out, we have to have a protection upon us, because one thing for sure, those cops had no business being up there on that floor with those guns showing their strength of force. It was some elder, old, retired cops there that people were thinking was a joke. But no, these older cops that's there that came in them wheelchairs and things, those are mamas and daddies of cold-blooded racism, you know, that came in there that don't like blacks, don't like blacks to stand up and speak out. So they were there to show their force. But the force of righteousness prevailed that day, as it always has done in the fight for the life of Mumia Abdul-Jabbar. You know, what we have here is a movement that is consistent. It is powerful because, I mean, and it's a multiracial movement. It is also a generational, you know, movement. It's a gender-based movement. And a people who know that Mumia is innocent, know that we have the information to bring him home. And no matter what they face us with, we continue to come back. And I want to thank Black Agenda Radio because they have been here from the beginning. And it's just no words that you can express for the, you know, not only do you hear it on the radio, but, you know, Black Agenda people be there in the courtrooms, in the streets, because they call you on a dime to find out what's going on, and they get actively involved in it.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.